Legoland Podcast with David Amoyal.
Benvenuti, as we would say in Italy. Welcome to all of you that don't speak Italian. Thank you so much for joining us for the second episode of the week during the international break of the Calcioland podcast. And we're here to cure your international break blues. This episode is brought to you courtesy from our great friends at Euro Fantasy Game, a place where you can play various fantasy football games. You can also read a lot of articles on Serie A and other leagues. There are great writers like Chloe Beresford, John Solano, have been on our podcast many times, as well as today's guest, Claudio Perfetto, who's going to join us on the second half of the pod to talk about Italy, Milan, and his podcast. So today I'm joined by our great friend, producer, co-host, Alex Goldberg. We saw each other at the Pearl Jam show on Tuesday, which we'll talk about at the end of the show. But before we get to that, the Twitter questions and the interview, I have this question for you, Alex. I think last week we were talking about who the best midfielders in Serie A are. We're kind of having a changing of the guard in that department. And we have another potential changing on the guard as far as who's going to lead Serie A and scoring at the end of the season. So we don't want to overreact to the first three games, and some teams only have two, but it's been a kind of a weird start. So at the top of the goal scoring standing, we have two names that I don't think anyone would have predicted at the beginning of the season. And this is Genoa striker Piątek, who has already three goals, and Fiorentina midfielder Benassi, who also has three goals. I don't know if they're going to be able to hold on and win the trophy for highest goal scorer, but their competition is off to a slow start. We have Icardi and Higuain, who have yet to score at all. We have four reliable strikers, Immobile, Dzeko, Belotti, and Mertens, who combined have four goals. They have a goal each. So rather surprising. So I have to ask you, Alex, I know you like to make a wager here or there. If you have to place a bet now, who's going to lead Serie A in scoring at the end of the season?
All right, David, my answer may surprise you. It is a player you listed. I'm going with Ciro Immobile, and here's why I'm going with Ciro. First of all, if he's in Serie A, he just flat out scores. I think globally, some people may think not as highly of Ciro if they're not Serie A fans, because they'll think of when he was hyped up in Serie A and then went to Borussia Dortmund and didn't do well. But on three different occasions in Serie A, he has had over 20 league goals. He had 22 for Torino, and then he had 23 for Lazio, and then last year he had 29 and 9 assists for Lazio. He had a delicious goal to start the season. He hasn't been great the last two games, but I'm saying Ciro, David, because he has one. Ronaldo could easily lead the league and he has zero, as you said. But I'm going to say that Milinkovic-Savic is going to heat up after a while. He'll obviously, when he's hot, he'll demand some attention, and he'll also be a provider, as he will be a goal scorer, but he'll certainly help Ciro Immobile score some goals. And Luis Alberto is certainly a good passer as well. So I'm going with Ciro Immobile. I mean, come on, he had 29 goals last year. He had 23 the year before. It's really not an outlandish pick at all. I'm hitching my wagon to Ciro, David. What about you?
I think that's a very good answer. As you mentioned, in Serie A, he kind of is a guarantee. If you look at the list of the strikers that have three seasons with 20 goals or more, it's really pretty elite company. I'll let you do your own research, but Immobile is really up there with some names that, more than anything, it's the names that don't have three seasons with 20 goals in Serie A that would surprise you. And he's done it, you know, teams that didn't qualify for the Champions League. So even more impressive. But I'm going to go, and I think your answer is fine. He'd probably be my backup. I'm going to go with Icardi. I just look at the talent around Inter. I think, you know, he's going to be excited by playing in the Champions League for the first time. But Inter's in a very tough group. I don't know if they're going to blatantly do like Napoli and mail it in. But I could see the focus being mainly on Serie A. I look at all the talented players around him. I think he's going to have a really big season. We're going to get into it on Monday's show. Gazzetta dello Sport released all the salaries in Serie A. Icardi definitely has some margin for improvement. They are discussing a new contract. I'm not saying that's going to be another huge motivating factor, but that certainly can't hurt. So I'm going to go with Icardi. I like your Immobile answer. I want to see what Ronaldo does. He usually, even at Real Madrid, started a little bit slow. He's not the wrong answer if you want to go with him. But I think of all of them, Icardi with Immobile right after, a little bit more of a sure thing. And speaking of sure things, we can always rely on our listeners to send fantastic Twitter questions. We got a lot today. We're going to save a few for Monday's show. As always, if you want to send us a question, you can tweet us using the CalcioLand hashtag. And which ones are we going to go over today, Alex?
All right, David, this is appropriate because the international break is upon us. So who do you consider to be the best players on the current Italy squad?
So when we did our power rankings, you and I, at the beginning of the season to figure out who the top teams were, you know, I kind of have my thing where I look at blue chip players, red chip players, something that I took from Mike Lombardi that covers the NFL. What I think is like a really good way to evaluate teams. With national teams, you know, the way I define it, at the club level, a blue chip player is like a top player that would be able to get considerable playing time at a club like Juve now. So a top team in Europe, the best team in Italy, someone that could play regular. So that's a blue chip player. A red chip player is just a notch below that. Someone who, you know, could start regularly for Napoli or Roma, be in that conversation. So when I look at Italy's squad, you know, I kind of ask myself, you know, how many of these players could realistically play for the top team, national teams? And I got to be honest, it's pretty grim to think about. I really don't see that many. You know, of the old guard, of course, Chiellini and Bonucci, you would still consider them blue chip players. Hey, they start for Juve, so they are. After that, it gets a little bit dicey. I think Romagnoli has really improved a lot. I think Romagnoli is ready to become a regular player for Italy as well. Let's see how long Chiellini holds on. I could see Romagnoli becoming Bonucci's partner again rather than at Milan on the Italian national team. After that, it gets even more dicey. I mean, with Buffon no longer in the equation, Donnarumma has taken a step back. Mancini pointed out that if Perin doesn't play regularly for Juve, he might struggle to get playing time there. We have Cragno of Cagliari, who's an up-and-coming goalkeeper who could do well. So even at the goalkeeper position, which usually for Italy was like a given that they'd have one of the best in the world, I don't know if they have it anymore. Jorginho, I definitely would consider a blue chip player. He's been excellent at Chelsea, but anyone who follows Serie A isn't that surprised by that. I think in a year or two, and maybe sooner, the best player on the Azzurri is going to be Chiesa of Fiorentina. So those are guys that I definitely see long term. You know, Bonucci and Chiellini, you know, after the Euro, who knows? And even let's see if Chiellini decides to go to the Euro. I see Romagnoli, Jorginho, and Chiesa as sure things. Beyond that, it gets a little bit dicey. So those are the ones that I would look at this moment.
All right, David. We talked about on the last episode Roberto Mancini and his comments about how Serie A teams should play Italian players more. So this next question is, what have been your impressions of Mancini so far?
So it's interesting because we've been talking a lot about Mancini when he was appointed and whatnot. And the thing that stood out to me always about Mancini more than his tactical ability was his ability as a recruiter, as kind of on the transfer market, getting his club to get him the players that he wanted, convincing players to come play for him, which maybe, you know, on paper, you'd think they had better offers. So I have to say one thing about Mancini, and he's already started this campaign, is to try to influence Serie A teams to play Italian players more. So I think, you know, his ability to influence people and places could be pretty useful here. So let's see if he's able to get this to happen. I will give him credit. I really liked his idea of calling some really young players to basically send the message to Serie A clubs, look, if you don't want to play them, I'll play them. And instead of sending them to the under 21 or the under 19 team, I'll just call them myself. So we had Monaco striker Pellegrini, who had came from Genoa, was selected. He had a minor injury, had to leave, but he was selected. Same with Roma midfielder Zaniolo, who was part of the Nainggolan deal. Mancini selected him right away. He's so young that he could play on the under 21 for another year or two, but Mancini just brought him on. So I'm pretty intrigued by what he's done so far. Let's see what happens on the pitch. I wasn't crazy about the Mancini appointment in the moment, but I have to say I'm warming up to it, and it really wouldn't surprise me if he exceeds expectations as a manager.
All right, David. The next Twitter question is, can Bernardeschi move to the midfield on the Italian national team?
It's very interesting that both Allegri has talked about Bernardeschi potentially moving to the midfield. And when you look at Juve, they are pretty thin in the midfield, especially after Marchisio left. Since we've done the podcast, it was announced he's going to be playing for Zenit, so best of luck to him. And Sturaro, who's going to go on loan at Sporting once he's healthy. So on Juve, he have an opportunity maybe to play as a mezzala in the midfield. And it's interesting that Mancini is thinking about it as well on the Italian national team. But I have to say, on Juve, to me, it makes more sense. I think on the Italian national team, where maybe up front there isn't that much talent, maybe he's more useful there. But it would be interesting to see if Bernardeschi can kind of strive in the midfield. So an interesting coincidence that both Mancini and Allegri are talking about this.
All right. How about this, David? Who do you see as Italy's top midfielder, and how would you compare the unit as a whole to previous Azzurri midfields?
Well, I think the easy answer is Jorginho. I think definitely the best midfielder on the Italian national team by a wide margin. I mean, probably the only good thing Ventura did, especially at the end, was at least select him, play him in an official match. At least he left a gift to his successor. Didn't get Italy to the World Cup, but at least got Jorginho on the team. Other than that, it gets really a little bit grim. De Rossi isn't with the team now. Pellegrini on Roma. It's been taking a little bit of a step back. Verratti, who I've been a big fan of for a while, A, it seems his career is a little bit in transition at PSG, but also on the Italian national team. I mean, I can't think of a signature moment he's had, a good game there. So look, the midfield's definitely an area of concern on the Azzurri, so maybe I'm contradicting myself. They could use Bernardeschi there as well, but I really just see Jorginho as the type of midfielder that could have started for, you know, maybe not started, but at least been a relevant player on a really good Italy team. So let's see if Benassi on Fiorentina can keep the momentum going and play well for the Azzurri, but we definitely need more of the young midfielders to emerge. It really wouldn't surprise me if Zaniolo ends up playing more frequently for Italy than he does for Roma, because you look at Roma, they have quite a few good foreign midfielders, so it's kind of a little bit counterintuitive, but it wouldn't shock me if he plays for Italy before he does for Roma.
Yeah, and I'm not just saying it because I'm a Chelsea fan, but it's definitely Jorginho. And if there's one thing that I've noticed about Jorginho since coming to Chelsea that maybe I didn't notice as much when he was at Napoli, is he really is a leader. He has taken on a leadership role with his new club. So have him on the Azzurri, he's going to be really important. One of their more important players, period, in terms of making the team a lot more cohesive. Not only is he just their best midfielder, but he might be one of their more important players, period. So, David, next question, and this is very interesting. Why doesn't Alan have any caps for Brazil? Is he underappreciated outside of Italy?
Hey, I'd say even before this season, he was probably a little bit underappreciated in Italy as well. I thought last season he was sensational for Napoli. You know, you and I talked about it on the podcast when we were talking about the best midfielders in Serie A. We put him in the conversation in the top three. I definitely think he belongs there. Just a very versatile player. The only thing missing are the goals. Other than that, he'd be very similar to what we saw Vidal doing at Juve. So definitely underappreciated, especially, I mean, I know Brazil has definitely more talent than Italy, but they could certainly use him. I know there's a lot of people that were asking me, you know, could Alan play for Italy at this point? Maybe Paulo Jorginho. I don't know if he has Italian ancestors, if they can find him some Italian ancestors, if they can get Recoba's guy for passport or something, but that'd be quite the coup for Italy. But I'm going to say that I think this season is when people are going to really, outside of Serie A, realize how good he is. I think Ancelotti is going to take him to the next level.
All right, David, this is an interesting question. What is wrong with the Italian Federation? Why would they want to place a fine on a team using a captain's armband to recognize Davide Astori's life?
This is a very good question. I know it's been debated a lot on Twitter. And, you know, I don't want to look in and of itself, the fact that the Italian Federation would consider fining Fiorentina for using a captain's armband, recognizing Astori on the surface sounds ludicrous, and you know, per se it is, but let's look at it in a little bit of a bigger picture. You know, if you don't have uniform standards for the captain's armband, what happens if someone wants to do something that could be offensive to some people, or some people, you know, get creative with the captain armband? They do things, you know, to recognize their pet or their girlfriend or whatnot. So I'm not defending the Astori part of this, but in general, I can understand why the Italian Federation would say, you know what, we don't want to have to decide what's appropriate or not. So we're just going to say you can't do anything that's beyond the standard, period. Now, again, there's a lot of blowback because of Astori per se, in and of itself. But again, I can understand how in general you're like, I don't want to have to legislate this. It's kind of like how in the Supreme Court in the US, they, you know, they were trying to define what pornography is. And someone's like, you know what? I can see, if I see it, I know if it's porn or not. And I think the Italian Federation's like, we don't want to have, want to decide this. But I do have a feeling something's going to give on this. It wouldn't surprise me if Fiorentina isn't fined at all for doing the Astori armband. I mean, just think of like the PR thing. And maybe they'll just say, okay, we'll give some guidelines as long as you don't have something like, you know, like a fascist symbol or something like that, which in Italy would be against the law. We won't do it. So it's an interesting topic. But again, I would advise listeners or anyone commenting on this to not maybe think about it so much about Astori, but in general, like you want to really have to legislate what's appropriate or not on these.
Very, very interesting. Okay, David, the next Twitter question is, what are your expectations for Milan's season?
So look, it's and we're going to get into it a little bit more when we have my friend Claudio Perfetto in the interview. We talked more about Milan than the other team because they are pretty interesting right now. Look, I think if you're a Milan fan, you got to feel really good about how the season started against Napoli. The first 60 minutes, they looked really, really good. Against Roma was an excellent match. Roma really didn't do much in that game. Granted, Milan won at the end. But there's definitely a lot of reasons for optimism. They're off to a good start. You know, they face two tough teams. They face two teams that finished in the Champions League. They have to make up a game. If they win that game, they're kind of on pace to be right behind Juve. Higuain has yet to score a goal. Caldara has yet to start a match. We've seen some good flashes from Castillejo. So look, if you're a Milan fan, you have to feel pretty good. I'm still not sure, you know, I definitely don't see them on the level of, say, Napoli and Inter. Are they closer to Lazio than I thought and Roma? Maybe. I think it's not out of the question that they finish top four. The trajectory, though, is very positive. I do think Milan's going to need at least two more transfer windows, so January and next summer. Hopefully next summer they're in much better place with financial fair play. If they could get a voluntary agreement with UEFA, that would go a long ways. But now that their ownership situation is much more settled, you got to feel really good. So if I had to buy stock on a team in Serie A, I mean, Milan would certainly be one of them.
Yeah, I'm still taking Milan ahead of Roma. I'm higher on Milan than I am on Roma. So, David, how about this? Why do you think Berlusconi and Galliani want to get involved with Monza?
That's it's a great story that comes up around international break, these kind of random stories. So we have Berlusconi, who, of course, had sold Milan, and I put that maybe in air quotes, to the Chinese, and now Elliot owns it. You know, there was some flirtation with maybe coming back to Milan right around the election in Italy. And now it looks like it's just a matter of time until they buy Monza. So for those of you that aren't familiar with Monza, they are a team right now in Italy's third division. They don't have a long tradition or anything like that. They are in a rich suburb outside Milan. That's where they do the Formula One GP. In Italy, it's actually where Galliani is from. He actually started his career as a director at Monza before he became Berlusconi's right-hand man. So I think Berlusconi kind of wants to get back in the game a little bit with football. It is a passion of his. They are in the third division, so now he's back to saying, I'm going to have an all-Italian team. Italy needs more Italian talents. I'm going to do it. We're going to go from the third division and work our way back to Serie A. So I think it's intriguing. Look, I find Berlusconi and Galliani to be, you know, obviously two huge figures in Italian football. If they're involved at this level, I think it's only a good thing. So it makes a lot of sense, especially for Galliani, because that's where he started.
All right, David, this next question is a personal question, meaning we have their name or their Twitter handle, I shall say. It's from Juventino Immortale, and they ask, I binge-watched Gamora on Netflix, but was bothered by the fact that there was barely any football mentioned at all. What's up with that?
Great question for so many reasons. So first of all, if you have yet to watch Gamora, the series, definitely do it. First two seasons, absolutely outstanding. If you're based in the U.S., they are on Netflix. If you can deal with subtitles, it's well worth it. You know, it's all in Neapolitan dialect, so after a while, I didn't need the subtitles. But great series. The first two seasons, unbelievable. I know this might sound like blasphemy, but literally on the level of Breaking Bad, almost The Wire and Sopranos, so it's that good. Also, the Twitter handle Juventino Immortale might be a tribute to one of the characters, Ciro Di Marzio, the Immortale, the Immortal. So great question. So he did mention that Napoli's barely mentioned. The series takes place in Napoli. It's all about the mob there. Like he said, they mentioned Hamsik once. You do see a lot of like posters of Napoli, but not so much the team. And I wonder if this was by design, if Napoli at first didn't want to be affiliated with a show that depicts the city in that light. It was also very interesting that a little while ago, Napoli was linked to two Lyon players, and that was Gonalons and Tolisso. Seeing how Gonalons did at Roma, maybe a blessing in disguise, he didn't come in Tolisso. And their agent said that, you know, they were eager to go to Napoli, but then they watched this TV show, Gamora, and they're like, Jesus Christ, if Napoli is like this, there's no way we're moving there. So I wonder if that's why Napoli didn't want to be affiliated with them that much. But since the first two seasons, there have been more, especially on social media. Napoli did a commercial with Dries Mertens and the main actor from Gamora. That was awesome. So I think there's a little more cross of the two. I've watched season three. That's not out in the U.S. yet. I got the DVDs. I wasn't thrilled with the season. Off the top of my head, I don't think there were many more references to football, but I think you'll see it at least in social media. So I wonder if the Gonalons and Tolisso incident kind of soured Napoli on this, but definitely an interesting scenario. But to any of our listeners that haven't watched Gamora, definitely do so. Absolutely worthwhile.
All right, David, last Twitter question. What do you expect from Thom Yorke's score of the Suspiria film?
So excellent question. So I'm going to be leaving for Italy pretty soon. We already recorded a podcast with our friend Andrew Barker to talk about movies and the Suspiria remake, which is a remake of Dario Argento's, a legendary Italian horror director. Is a movie that I know is on Andrew's radar. It premiered at the Venice Film Festival. And Tom York of Radiohead did the soundtrack. So I'm very curious to hear it. It's going to be released as an album. So I'm looking forward to it for a couple of reasons. A, Tom York, I could see him being really excellent at soundtracks. His bandmate, Johnny Greenwood, has been doing the soundtracks of P.T. Anderson's movies for quite some time. He's been nominated for the Oscars many times. So I'm very curious to see if Tom York is going to be as good. To me, Tom York is one of the best singers out there, period. But he's also really, he does a lot of DJ sets, is really into ambient music and whatnot. So I'm very curious to see what he does, especially on a horror movie of this scale. So it should be rather intriguing. I'm very curious to see if he can keep up with Johnny Greenwood. So those are our Twitter questions for the week. We're going to do some more podcasts next week, so keep them coming. Please send them in using the CouchLand hashtag. I want to also take this opportunity to thank all our listeners that support our work beyond sending in questions. Those of you that tweet about the podcast, we're really grateful. You guys are our marketing department. Please let your friends know what we do. If you have yet to leave us a rating on iTunes, we really appreciate it. Literally takes 5 seconds. You're listening to us on your iPhone. Please search for CouchLand on the iTunes. You can find us there. Scroll down a little bit. You can tap and leave us a 5-star rating. You want to take it a step further, you know, leave us a comment. We'll definitely read them. And now for the interview part of the segment, we're going to be joined by a great friend, Claudio Perfetto. We'll talk about Italy and go around Serie A. Okay, and for the interview part of the podcast, we are joined by my very good friend and colleague on Di Marzio's site, Claudio Perfetto. He's been doing a lot of cool things recently. Most importantly, his podcast, An Idiot and an Expert, that I really dig. It's a pretty cool concept. We'll get into that towards the end of the show. You also, other than Di Marzio's site, can read him on CS Sports Football, on SempreMilan.com, on RawZone Linear.org. He also writes occasionally on Euro Fantasy Game. So it's a real pleasure to have you on, Claudio. Welcome back to CouchLand.
Thanks, David. Thanks for having me. Always a pleasure to come on the podcast and speak to you, since we are such good friends even off the podcast.
Awesome. Good stuff. So what I figured we do today, Claudio, it's because it's in the international break, kind of talk a little bit about the Azzurri and then take stock a little bit about what's going on in Serie A. So let's start with the Azzurri. After not appearing in the World Cup, it kind of feels like year zero. We have Mancini, he's been trying to shake things up by calling some younger players, denouncing the fact that not enough Italian players play for the top teams in Serie A. So with everything that's going on, the Euro's coming in about 2 years. Based on what you see now with the Azzurri, what would you say is a best-case scenario for Italy at the Euro in 2 years?
Well, hopefully, first of all, they do qualify for it. I think they shouldn't have a problem. It's a little bit easier to qualify for the Euros than it is for the World Cup. But that would be first. And I would say a semifinal run would be a major success for them, especially if it's a group of a younger core of players. You know, in 2020, the Euros will be going to 24 teams, which out of the 24, 16 will make it out of the group stage. So making it out of the group stage just wouldn't be enough for them. Not making it out of the group stage would be a total failure and another embarrassment. So I would think that a semifinal run, quarterfinals is realistic and somewhere where they'll probably end up, but a semifinal run with a lot of young guys making an impact would probably be the most that Italy could ask for, just because, you know, Spain, Germany, France, the big European teams right now have a lot of talent, a lot of younger talent, so they're still going to be forces to be reckoned with in 2 years. So I don't know if Italy would have enough to overcome those guys.
Yeah, I agree with everything you said. I'm with you. They should have a much better chance of qualifying. But after what we saw with the World Cup, you can't take that for granted. And yeah, I'm with you. I feel like they are definitely, as of now, a step below the other teams that you mentioned. So now let's talk about Mancini's big gripe at the first press conference of the week. He brought up a couple of times that, you know, there's not enough Italian players starting regularly for the top teams. Even beyond that, compared to after the 2006 World Cup, we had more than double the amount of Italians that were playing in the first three matches in Serie A. This season, it was less than half than back in 2006. So to me, the question is, you know, obviously 2006 was a golden generation for Italy, a great team. I think we saw it, you know, not the following World Cup, but in 2012, still pretty good nucleus. But to me, the talent has gone down. So I got to ask you, do you think the Serie A clubs are pragmatic and they're like, look, we need to field the best team possible? Or do you, and, you know, there's just not enough good Italians for the top teams? Or do you think this is kind of a result of that because they're not playing enough Italian players? They're not getting reps in games that the talent has gone down.
Yeah, well, first of all, I thought it was kind of ironic for Mancini to mention that, because when he was coaching Inter, you know, he wasn't exactly known for fielding a majority Italian players on the field. So I guess it depends on your point of view in life, what your opinion is. And that's a perfect example of that. Even though he did have some younger players like Balotelli that he gave opportunities to. But look, I'm of the opinion that if there was a lot of young, talented Italian players, why would the teams not want to play them? It just doesn't make any sense. I don't think there's an agenda to stop the teams from playing top young Italian players. I think it's a lack of talent. I mean, Italy, who would you say right now is a clear world-class player on Italy that they've had in years past, especially attacking options like Totti, Baggio, Del Piero? Italy doesn't possess that right now. And look at a team like Juventus, who historically had always played a lot of Italian players, and even they've shied away from that lately because of the lack of talent. You know, the ones that are talented, like a Bernardeschi, they take risks and they sign those types of players, but there just isn't enough talent in the country to field, you know, a team that's trying to win the Champions League. And these clubs, you can't forget, at the end of the day, they're businesses, and their priority is not to produce Italian talent and make the Italian national team the best it could possibly be. Their priority is to make money, make it into the Europa League, make it into the Champions League, try to win those competitions, stay away from relegation. Those are their priorities, and that's what makes them money. So you can't really fault them. There's no clear-cut reason why they wouldn't play Italian players if you know, they were there and they were available to them. I mean, a lot of the argument is that the foreign players, the younger foreign players are cheaper. But, you know, the homegrown Italians are right there, and they invest in them at a young age. So when it gets to the point where they're ready to make that leap to the first team, it wouldn't be my expectation that the teams are willing to play them. So I just think it's really the lack of talent that is keeping them away from playing first team football for the best clubs in Italy.
Interesting. So now let's transition back to Serie A. We're on the international break. We've had, you know, most teams have played three matches. We have a small sample size. We don't want to overreact, but there are some themes that are emerging. And the first one's a theme that actually has been going on for quite some time. We have Allegri. I think this Juve in my lifetime, I can't think of a time they had so much offensive talent. Where, you know, Juve is playing close to the vest, not the most exciting football. So it seems there's a lot of Juve fans that are really upset with the way Allegri is managing the team. I would also point out, though, that a lot of these same fans are the ones that mock Sarri, saying, yeah, you won the prize for beautiful football, but no trophies, nobody's going to remember you. But that aside, tell me a little bit your point of view on this. Do you think they have a point that maybe Allegri isn't getting the most out of his team and that amazing offensive talent at his disposal?
Yeah, well, you know, it was funny. I was going to bring it up because I heard you say last week about Xavi and how they, you know, they mock them about his style and it doesn't win championships. And with Allegri, it's interesting because they definitely have many attacking options. And you would like to see him play a little bit more attractive football, especially if you're a fan of the team. But it's a good problem to have, I guess, when you know the results are there and now you just want the football to be a little bit more pleasing. But this is a man who got them to the Champions League final the year after Conte basically said that the team wasn't good enough to compete in the competition. So he's done a great job for them. He has a very difficult job, believe it or not, because the expectations are so high. You know, they're pretty much guaranteed to win in Italy every year. And even though their talent is so much better and deeper than everybody else, they still have to go out and play the games. And he's managing a lot of personalities. He has to manage a lot of depth, you know, which is not easy. It might seem like a good problem to have, but players want to play, especially at that level and the best players in the world. And, you know, the beginning of the season, he's just going to feel out who his best players are, who he can rely on the most. And the most important thing is to get the results because, you know, they want to be comfortably ahead of the rest of the pack, I think, when March hits and February hits and the Champions League round of 16 is back. And you know, they would like to have a good lead in Serie A so that way they could focus on that competition. So I think they should definitely be a little bit easier on him. He is a man who has pretty much won all he could have at Juve in the past 4 years, except for the Champions League. But even that, he's brought them to the brink two times, and he definitely deserves the benefit of the doubt. And they don't play that terribly, in my opinion. You know, they're very straightforward, direct. They go and they try to do whatever they need to do to win games, which is, you know, a good thing for a team of their level and stature with so many options.
So now let's talk about the rest of Serie A. I think it was yesterday, gave an interview saying basically Juve are in their own class. We're battling for second for the other teams. And the start of the season seems to have kind of confirmed that. So let me ask you, out of the rest of the field, who would you say has the best chance to finish second based on what you've seen, based on the squads or anything else for that matter?
Well, you know, talent-wise, I would think that Inter and Napoli are the second-best team, you know, the two teams I would fight for that. But I trust Napoli more than Inter, and their team coming off of 91-point season, which is unheard of. I think it's one of the top five totals in Serie A history and the highest total to now win the competition. So they're still the favorites for second place for me. They added Ancelotti, who, even though Ancelotti has as great as of a career as he's had, he's only won one Scudetto. So I don't think bringing him in really makes your Scudetto contender or a favorite. But he is a coach who knows how to perform well and get the best out of his team. So I think if anybody could get them close to where they were last year, it would be him. And they're still very, very talented. In the first two games against Lazio and Milan, they show that they have that mentality where, you know, even if they're behind and losing a match, they could still come back and win. It didn't work out for them against Sampdoria, obviously, but that's a tough place to play on the road, given everything that just happened in the city as well. It was a difficult match. And, you know, it looks like it kind of seemed like their bad starts from the first 2 weeks would eventually catch up to them, and that's what happened. But over the course of the season, I'm still going to bet on them, even though Inter, I think, has just a talented of a roster. They always go through that Pazza Inter phase, you know, that run of games where they don't get results, and it kind of started already this season for them in the first two games. But over the course of the year, I don't know if they're as proven as Napoli has been. So that's why I would, you know, still pick Napoli for the second place this season.
Okay, so you've kind of answered the next question, but I'll ask it anyway. So we've seen Inter, Roma, and Napoli already lose a match this season. Which ones do you think has the most reason for concern and why?
For me, it's Roma over the course of the season. You know, obviously, like you said, I think Napoli and Inter would battle out for second place. I think Roma has a lot of reasons for concern, mainly their defense. They have not looked good. Fazio was great for them last season, but that was kind of an anomaly. And if he wants to prove that he's that type of player that he showed last year, he's going to have to be much better than he has been in the first three matches of this season. He has not looked good, and you know, him and Manolas are really the strong defensive pairing that they're relying on. And then on top of that, you know, they sold sure things like Mangalan, Strootman, Allison. You know, those are guys that were starters for them, started majority of their games. They really relied on, and they kind of brought in question marks instead. You know, guys that could perform at that level, could get there, but maybe aren't there right now. And for me, you know, they've transitioned now. They've made a lot of signings the past two seasons. It's always tough to come out of the gates with a bunch of new signings, because it takes a while for a team to gel, and especially when you get rid of, you know, really important players, especially like Nangalan and Allison. It's going to be difficult for them, I think, to compete at the levels of the top three like they were last year. But, you know, it's a long season, and DeFrancesco is a good coach. But at this point, you know, they're the team for me that I would worry most about out of the top four from last season.
Yeah, I'm definitely with you there. So now let's talk a little bit about Milan. Now, I know you also got to see them in person the beginning of August out on the West Coast. So it's a small sample size, even smaller than the other teams, because their first match had to be rescheduled. So tell me a little bit, what has stood out to you on what you've seen so far from them?
So Gattuso's impact has been very, very positive for them. He has them playing together. He has them playing for each other and for him. Obviously, the additions of Leonardo and Maldini in the front office has brought a lot of positivity and optimism to the club. There's no more ownership questions, which are really important, even, you know, on the field, because, you know, players, I'm sure, in the back of their mind were worried about what was going to happen with the club last season, and those were all eliminated. As far as the on-the-field product, Higuain has been tremendous in the first two games. Even though he hasn't scored, they haven't had a player of that quality since Ibrahimovic, in my opinion. He's kind of reverting back to that Napoli role that he used to have, where he's not only a poacher and going to try and score goals, he's really coming back to get the ball. He's included in the build-up play. He's switching the field for Milan. He's been awesome. And just that assist to Cutrone just shows, you know, what kind of player he is. And he seems like he's really buying in, which has been a big positive for me. And then the other thing I would say that's positive for them is the ability to bring in players like Laxalt, Castillejo, and Cutrone off the bench. Last year with Bonaventura, Suso, Çalhanoğlu, when those guys ran out of ideas, it was pretty much a done deal. When Cutrone was starting and wasn't scoring, they would bring in Kalinic, Andre Silva off the bench, and they really didn't perform well for them. You know, this Roma game, you saw what Castillejo, what Laxalt, and what Cutrone were able to do towards the end of the game. They kept pressing with the high line. You know, Castillejo is very quick, which is something they missed big time last season. They had no really fast players. So I think that's really great for their depth, and for Gattuso, when he needs to switch things up, he has that ability. But then negatively, one thing that stood out to me is Donnarumma. He has not looked good. Even, like you said, I watched them on the West Coast. I went to a training session, actually, also, and watched him practice. He just looks a little unsure of himself this year. He's not very secure. His decision-making has been a little bit off. So, you know, if they want to go far, they're going to need him to step up and be who he was, you know, when he first came out, because I kind of feel like he's hit a little bit of a wall and he's not getting better. So, you know, that's something that I would like to see change for the better in the coming weeks, and something that they'll probably have to work out.
That's interesting on Donnarumma for certain. So now let's talk about another player. It almost feels like as he goes, so does the rest of the team. If Milan loses, I read a bunch of tweets on Biglia being terrible. If Milan has a great match, usually is Biglia's played pretty well. So tell me, in your opinion, is he arguably one of the most important players on the team? And what do you think he brings to the table?
Yeah, I would say him, Higuain, and Romagnoli are the three guys in the starting 11 that are pretty much irreplaceable, that they need on the pitch every game in order to be successful. Like you said, it's like love him or hate him. You know, whenever they win, he's very important for them. When they lose, people are angry at him. The Napoli game towards the end, he was getting tired. It was the first game of the season. It was understandable. He didn't really play much in the preseason because of the World Cup. He didn't travel to the United States. So he was still probably just trying to get his legs under him. But he's such an important player. He kind of sets the tempo for them. He is huge defensively. You know, his cover is very, very important. And they don't really have a backup for him, which is a major problem. You know, Bakayoko, they tried to play him in Delia's position for the last 30 minutes or so against Napoli. Didn't work out too well. He did not look comfortable. So, you know, right now the backup, I guess, would be, you know, Jose Mauri or Bertolacci. But, you know, we've already seen that those guys have pretty much a ceiling and aren't going to be able to perform at his level. So just on the pure number of people at his position and who the substitutes are, I would say that he's definitely, you know, the most important player on the team for them. And he's been great on the Gattuso, so hopefully he could put it together for a whole season.
Okay, so now let's talk about your podcast. For those of you that haven't figured out, you're calling in from New York. I have a great New York accent. So your podcast is called Idiot and an Expert Podcast. So the concept is, you know, it's geared for more American fans that are kind of getting into soccer. The sport's kind of exploding here. I really dig the concept. You guys cover a lot of different topics. And we're going to call it soccer for the purpose of this. A lot of times compared to American sports. So tell me a little bit. Now you've gotten quite a few episodes under your belt. We had you on when you guys were getting started. So now that you have 14 episodes under your belt, what are some of the things that you've learned? You know, Alex and I get a lot of questions on guys that are starting their podcast. When you started, you asked me a couple of questions. So let me ask you, what have you learned from the ones you've done so far?
Yeah, well, one thing for sure that I admire you guys for is the consistency. It's very tough to be consistent and produce episodes, you know, on a routine basis. Every week, you know, it's hard to get two people's schedules in order and on time at the same time every week. And I know during the transfer window, you guys really go crazy. So that's very impressive. And that's one of the things for me that I thought would be easier than it is. You know, it's hard to be consistent just because, you know, you're trying to work at fitting it in your schedule every week. So that's one thing. Then just the topics, like you said, we do such a broad range of things because we're comparing stuff to American sports and American athletes. It's very easy to go off of tangents and just, you know, talk about something for like 20 to 30 minutes when we probably really shouldn't be. So, you know, it has to be very structured. When going into it, you probably don't realize that. You think that, you know, you just go and you talk to your friend basically for 30 to 45 minutes or whatever and call it a day. But just getting on the same page as far as schedule and then narrowing it down topic-wise and making sure that you're staying on topic for just the right amount of time and not too little and not too much. Those have been the biggest, surprises to me. But it's been very fun. You know, talking about sports and football and all the other sports is fun. And my co-host, like you said, doesn't really know much about the sport. So getting to teach him and, you know, even make fun of him and mock him once in a while has been fun. So it's definitely a fun thing to do, but it is not as easy as you would think it is.
So everyone, definitely check it out. I know there's a lot of great podcasts out there, but I like that Claudio came up with kind of a different podcast that's out there. So I can't thank you enough for joining us, buddy. Always a pleasure to have you on. Any articles you're working on or people should keep their eye out on for?
No, just, you know, my normal stuff on for Di Marzio is if you're looking for transfer or Serie A news, you know, follow me there. And then Euro Fantasy, I've been actually covering Chelsea for them. So Alex and I have that in common. I watch Alex's videos for a lot of input on Chelsea because I don't follow them as closely as he does, that's for sure. So thanks, Alex, for that stuff. And, you know, other than that, on Cloud Sports, I have a little bit of free range and I like to do power rankings and previews and match reviews and things of that nature. So just go to my Twitter page to find anything I'm writing on if you're interested, and then listen to the podcast.
Awesome. Well, Claudio, thank you so much for joining us, and I look forward to chatting with you real soon. Thanks again.
Thanks, David.
Okay, so now let's end on some pop culture. We're going to do it a little bit differently than what we've done in the past. So I mentioned at the beginning of the podcast, we're recording this on Thursday. Tuesday night, I saw Alex at Fenway Park where the Red Sox play. Usually I know Alex goes there a lot for baseball, but we went to see Pearl Jam. It was my second time seeing them on this tour. I'd seen them some times before. I know for you, Alex, this was your first time seeing Pearl Jam. I kind of feel like an older brother, you know, showing the little brother albums and be like, you have to hear this, and getting you going on that. So tell me, what was your impression of that? Did you enjoy the show?
I really enjoyed it, and I'm not just saying that. I was blown away, totally blown away. Now, I must start off by saying, David, I have probably been to as many concerts in my whole life that you've been to in 1 year. However, I've been to a couple rock, I've been to a couple hip-hop, and I would say a couple from any genre I listen to. And I gotta say, and I am not just saying it, that was the best concert I have ever been to. You really did not just say they were great live to say they were great live. They are truly, truly great live. I think the number one word that stands out to me, David, about their performance is commanding. Totally commanding. Now, you can be a fan of rock or not a fan of rock and just be a fan of music. And the minute they started playing, they had your attention for the whole entire time. Of course, Eddie Vedder is just an awesome vocalist. And I would say that I didn't know as much about Pearl Jam as I necessarily did Eddie Vedder. I had seen Eddie Vedder sometimes solo doing tributes to other people. And I definitely knew of some of Pearl Jam's top hits. However, my big takeaway, David, was the guitarist, Mike McCready, who I think when you listen to music, and anybody listening to this knows exactly what I'm talking about. When you're truly blown away by music, you could cry, or you might definitely get goosebumps. And David, he had a guitar riff. I feel like you know which one I'm talking about, but then again, he had like five or six incredible guitar riffs. But he, maybe his first guitar riff of that show, I kept thinking, okay, this is ridiculous. You know, he's playing it behind his back, and I'm like, this is ridiculous. It'll probably end in a second. A minute goes by. Oh, it's probably over now. 3-4 minutes go by, and he's still going. It was truly jaw-dropping. I remember turning to you and just being like, wow. And I've never been able to play the guitar. I always wanted to play the guitar as a kid. And I was reminded that night of why I want to be able to play the guitar. I think that's one of the most badass things you can possibly do. I was blown away. David, the last thing I would say is I feel like Pearl Jam, and correct me if I'm wrong, as long as you have a music lover, because Pearl Jam is not hard rock, it's not heavy metal, but maybe it's also not like the softest rock. I feel like if you're just a music lover, Pearl Jam, at least seeing them live, would be almost down anybody's avenue.
Very well said. I have a lot of thoughts on what you said. So interesting. I mean, I've taken my wife to a lot of concerts. I took her to see Pearl Jam twice. And the first time I took her to see her was at Fenway 2 years ago. And they played a fairly mellow show, like not that many rock songs. And like, before we went, she goes, oh, Pearl Jam's not even a rock band. And I told her, I was like, honey, they definitely are. I was like, any band that has mainly guitars, like, to me is a rock band. But, like, the first three albums are like, you know, they're not heavy metal, but they are definitely hard rock. And the night you saw, they were definitely rocking pretty hard. And yeah, the thing about Mike McCready is like, if you listen to a Pearl Jam album, yeah, definitely there are some good solos, but like live, they just go into it a lot more. Like, there are some songs that they played during these two shows that I wasn't that familiar with. And then I went to listen to the album version, and I could barely recognize from the live version because they were rocking so much harder. So, yeah, definitely he was the highlight in a lot of ways for me of those shows. You know, there's this thing calling people a guitar hero. And to me, the meaning of that was also there were some of the songs that they played to Tuesday after the first two that were kind of like, not their best songs, but he would just come in with like a crazy solo and kind of rescue the song. And like you said, I go to a lot of shows, and like now if I see a band multiple times, like I almost start breaking it down like it's a football game. And I was like, taking count of how long some of the solos were, we had a bunch of really long guitar solos, then we had a couple of long keyboard solos, and I was like, okay, so Eddie Vedder's catching his breath. I mean, he's like, I think he's like 53 or 54, and he was like, his voice was amazing, but you could tell he was kind of like resting up, and then he would come in really, really hot after taking a short break. So yeah, so for anyone that's kind of like on the fence on going to rock shows, like I was like, you know, when Alex, you told me I don't go to a lot of these shows, to me it's kind of like you go see Pearl Jam on a light like that at Fenway, it's kind of someone who's never been to an NBA game and they see LeBron James for the first time and they're like, oh my god. So it's definitely a lot of fun. I'm very glad we did it. It was definitely a cultural and experience. We talked about football and then got to see the show. So hopefully this will be the first of many shows we go see.
Yeah, David, one thing to add. I got to add it because you're bringing up seeing LeBron and we were talking about Mike McCready. After that insane first guitar riff, and I have major respect for this. I don't know if you remember, but Eddie Vedder then announces him to the crowd and says he's got rock fever, but he also has a fever. He played that with a fever. And you, funny enough, right after the guitar riff turned to me and said, that was kind of like how Jordan does his one-hand pump fake. Michael Jordan, for anybody that doesn't know, usually in basketball, you do a two-hand pump fake. Michael Jordan, just because he can, always did a one-hand pump fake. And you equated that to Mike McCready just going on and on and on because he can. And then it's funny because we figure out he has a fever, and then your Jordan parallel is even more apt because Jordan is famous for playing in an NBA Finals having the flu. So I just thought that was amazing.
Yeah, too, definitely that. And it's also like, I feel like someone like him, you know, they want to keep the interesting for them. Like, granted, they don't do as many shows as they used to, but it's like how Larry Bird would play a game and would say, okay, tonight I'm just going to shoot with my left hand just to keep it interesting. So a lot of that. So I'm glad we did it. It was a lot of fun. You guys know I love rock music. I'm glad I'm starting to rub off a little bit on Alex on this. So for all our listeners, as always, keep the questions on football coming, but also send us some music and TV questions. I think Alex is going to start becoming a rock expert too, so you can start directing questions at him as well. So I want to thank everyone for tuning in. We hope we've been able to cure a little bit of your international break blues. We're going to come back with some more episodes next week. Then I'll be in Italy, but I'm sure we'll find a way to keep the show going. Alex has been doing a great job, so we'll keep Calcioland going. And thank you, everyone, for joining us today.